So I think this may be my favorite title of any session at this year's Greenbelt. It's called Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy. I mean, there are some of the very best words right there in that title, aren't there? Some of my very favorite words. Lynn Segal teaches at Birkbeck University of London. And I'm told that she's just flown in from Malmo, where she's been speaking at a conference. So we're very grateful for her not only battling the European transit system, but also battling from the car park to get here today to be with us. She's going to help us think through anxiety, depression, happiness, and our quest for a better world. Please give her a very warm Greenbelt welcome.
Thank you very much, and it is wonderful to be here. I've never been at Greenbelt before, and as you've just heard, I've flown in from Malmo, and I shouldn't have been flying at all, particularly because I was at a degrowth conference, and that was a pretty depressing but incredibly enlightening experience, not just the loss of species diversity almost every day, a new species dying out, but the threat indeed to the human species as well, if we don't manage to curb the amount of energy and carbon emissions that we're emitting. So it was very interesting for me to learn from there, and I'm sure that I'll also learn here. But my title, Collective Joy, Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy, what a weird title it might seem for this time, more than ever after that degrowth conference that I was just at. Because here, not only are so many of us worried about what's happening in the world, worried about the future, but looking around the world, you can see that we are living, it seems, in a profoundly dystopian time, when it's the dystopian imagination that is everywhere evident with any form of utopic yearning, it seems, or utopic visions for the future, all but obliterated from the most popular fantasies about the future. Think Blade Runner, where set in Los Angeles, where even the air is rationed, daylight is rationed. Hunger Games, set in a wasteland, where teenage Amazons compete and die in their games. Handmaid's Tale, with half the human race enslaved. I could go on and on, actually. Much of the most popular fiction, much of the most popular film and so on is incredibly dystopic. So they resonate, of course, with what I'm sure many of you know. This changes everything with ever more chilling reports on climate change, on water shortage, alongside our knowledge of ongoing military actions, conflict, displacement, destitution, violence still around the globe, with the Mediterranean chillingly carpeted almost daily with the drowned bodies of those seeking asylum. If these waves could talk, what terrible stories they would tell us. Coming here, in fact, I read an article in the New Yorker announcing that this is a golden age of dystopian fiction. That's what's selling well. How ironic is that, particularly for you all here, I imagine. How many dire warnings do we need, I wonder, for us to be certain, at the very least, that we live in all too troubling, turbulent times when so many feel more precarious than ever. Moreover, nowadays we may feel that the spectre that is haunting Europe and much of the rest of the world is no longer communism, as Marx and Engels declared so dramatically in their manifesto exactly 170 years ago, but rather right-wing populism, whose most powerful representative now presides literally in the White House. Yet, fortunately, after all that turbulence, that's not quite the end of the matter, or not yet. There are always other dynamics at play. Perhaps surprisingly, resistance solidarity is also on the ascendancy. On the ascendancy after 40 years of global neoliberal rationality that's fueled that triumph of reactionary populism after the welfare shrinkage, the market triumphalism, the uber individualistic frameworks that surround us. So I hardly need tell you here, I'm sure, that this is a rationality that's disdainful of collective life, of spiritual life, and of our basic interdependency, whether for the care, love, and labor of others, as well as for maintaining the Earth's resources on which we all rely. However, I take very seriously the words of that cultural scholar, Raymond Williams, writing shortly before his death in 1988. To be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. Those dystopian fictions and fantasies are all about despair. Rather than making that convincing, what we have to try and make convincing, I'm going to argue, is to make hope possible. So that's what Raymond Williams wrote in his book, Resources for Hope, which was published after he died. Thus, strange as it may seem, sometimes even strange to me, raising issues of joy and collectivity in the present is just what I've been trying to write about and talk about in that book of mine. However, it's not quite so simple, because another thread throughout that book is to insist that joy and woe are woven fine. By the way, is there nowhere for you to sit at the back? Couldn't you come up and sit somewhere else? It's horrible to be standing, isn't it? I'm sure there are some spaces. Anyway, it was Blake, 400 years ago, who said joy and woe are woven fine. And in particular, it seems to me that joy rarely arrives without the shadow of its loss, without a certain temporal fragility. Moreover, the future, although it's looking very bleak right now, or certainly very bleak for many, with the threat of climate change and so on, one thing that I think we also need to know is that when change does happen, it often arrives quite unexpectedly. So I'm going to tell you about some of those unexpected changes that have happened over the years. So I'm going to talk to you about some of those utopian moments, which I think it's important for us to think about and to realize that we've never been very good at predicting the future. Not even those Marxist thinkers who believe that science is always heading us in one direction. We've never been good at predicting the future, because the momentous events that begin to change the course of history usually take people quite by surprise. And it's why we always need, I think, to hold on to a certain critical historical view of the present, as well as to hold on to our microphones and the present's past, before we try as best we can to understand the future and orientate ourselves to the future. For instance, it's exactly half a century, 50 years, since the upheavals of 1968. Back then, in the Western world, apart from in Franco's Spain and Salazar's authoritarian dictatorship in Portugal, there was a sudden surge of collective resistance, of collective joy, of utopian yearning. We shall fight, we shall win in Paris, London, Rome, Berlin, as the UK's radical magazine Black Dwarf declared, headed up by the best-known 60s radical, still very much around today and still as radical as ever, Tariq Ali. Form dream committees, demand the impossible, and so on, with the situationist-inspired slogans daubing the walls in Paris as General de Gaulle fled the city, briefly in the grip of students and workers together in joyful revolt, confidently demanding self-management by workers, decentralization of economic and political power alongside participatory democracy at the grassroots. Interesting, these are all the things that they were arguing for at the degrowth conference. All they were wanting, these street-fighting rebels, was an end to exploitative capitalist working conditions and to pointless consumerism. Again, it was so relevant for the degrowth people, as well as to American imperialism, and especially then, an end to the Vietnam War and the whole military-industrial complex generally. That's all they were wanting. Now, ironically, the lasting legacies of May 68 mostly did not involve that street-fighting man who was shouting so fiercely from the barricades, but rather, and interestingly, the rapid growth of various sorts of movement politics, and especially the women's liberation movement. We were the true inheritors of May 68 as we began to try and rethink the future with women included there alongside men. Now, interestingly, because I'm going to keep giving you a little bit of history before racing forward again, the two decades immediately preceding May 68 had been for the most part, the most quiescent and conformist in Europe and the Western world, with people retreating into domesticity and, in particular, accelerating consumerism in post-war retrenchment. It's actually when we began to get this massive consumerism, which is now causing so many of our problems around climate change and so on. Indeed, post-1945, the best-known public intellectuals broadcast the view that democracy and utopian thinking of any kind were opposed. The latter declared impossible and dangerous. One of the most influential European emigres was the British philosopher Karl Popper, who argued in his classic essay, Utopia and Violence, that while utopia or thinking of a better world, better times, may look desirable, all too desirable, it was in practice a dangerous and pernicious idea, self-defeating and leading only to violence. It was said to be always a form of totalitarian thinking, and that was one of the chief accusations throughout the Cold War, that to sort of hope for something more equal, something fairer for everybody in the world, was a dangerous thing to be doing. However, as another earlier philosopher, Walter Benjamin, once wrote, nothing that's ever happened should be regarded as lost for history. And that's another thought that particularly those of you who are political activists, I think sometimes recall, if times have been better before, if we've been able to improve things before, then surely we can do so again. And almost a century before May 68, there'd been the Paris Commune in 1871, which, though ending in bloody defeat after only 2 months, was the very first time workers took power and would spread radical visions for workers' control and democratic self-government around the world. The ideas that motivated its activist men and women alike had been building for over 20 years, as Kristen Ross discusses in her instructive book, Communal Luxury, the Political Imaginary of the Paris Commune. As Ross explains, Louise Michel was one of the most illustrious women who had then played a large part in preparing for and supporting that Paris Commune, in organizing debating clubs that thrived throughout 1868, involving both pedagogy and entertainment. And while it lasted, the commune adopted equal pay for male and female teachers, and also made significant changes in education for both children and adults so that more workers could become teachers, thereby breaking down divisions between manual labor and intellectual workers, something we've still to do. Thus, although dystopian scenarios came to dominate speculation about the future in as the 20th century progressed, closing with talk of end times and indeed even the destruction of humanity itself, it had all begun rather differently and was interrupted by many high moments of shared joy. The late 19th and early 20th century had generated, and this is the settling in of industrial industrialization, but it had generated many diverse utopian yearnings for moving beyond the cruelties of early capitalism with its inevitable class struggle and its murderous imperial rivalry. These visions were influential before being largely beaten back, almost entirely beaten back, by the carnage of the First World War, by the imperial rivalry that happened in the early 20th century. But meanwhile, in the USA in 1880, Edward Bellamy, his best-selling science fiction, Looking Backwards, imagined the world from 2000, from the time we are now. Now, interestingly, it would be one that was the very opposite of how the world has turned out. It would be one where the state had gained control of the reins of technological growth, taken over the corporations to create an egalitarian utopia. This meant huge improvements in housing and public resources, as well as in workers' conditions, with everyone retiring to pursue their own interests by the age of 45. And also, those who were doing the manual sort of dirty jobs like cleaning, collecting the garbage and that, they would have shorter hours and better wages. Everything was worked out so that it would all look very fair and everybody would feel that what they were doing was important. Now, as we know, exactly the opposite has happened. And it's welfare resources and the public sector that have literally got sold off to the private sector. So instead of having something nearer to that vision, we have just about the opposite of that vision. And yet that vision actually did have an impact. So even when we lose, we sometimes also win certain things. So it very much fed into the municipal developments that happened in parts of America and parts of Europe, the creation of those garden cities, the expansion of housing was very much fed by ideas like those of Bellamy. However, over here, William Morris, another important utopian thinker, didn't like the technocratic and state-centric notion of what Bellamy was writing, although, like all radicals of his day, we've got him up good, Morris was appalled by the squalor and misery of 19th century urban industrialism, prompting him to write his own classic utopian novel, News from Nowhere, which was serialized throughout the 1890s. Here, his narrator has a dream in which cities have turned green again, while federations of skilled craftsmen, and skilled craftsmen were very significant at this time, have created federalized communities, both within the state and then around the world, filled with public gardens, markets, and communal meeting places. And the book concludes by suggesting that if others could only see the future as he had, then it would become a vision of the possible rather than a dream. And let me tell you, unlike Bellamy, Morris did not like the idea of the centralized state and thought the House of Parliament would be a very good place to store manure. Anyway, it was the maverick Marxist historian Edward Thompson who did most to put William Morris back on left agendas in recent times, arguing for a new alliance between socialism and utopianism. And later using the French philosopher Miguel Abensor to stress his great significance. It was Abensor who coined the memorable phrase, the education of desire, to suggest that what Morris was offering was not any concrete blueprint for the future, like most utopian thinkers today. They are not offering concrete visions of the future, but what he offered was to liberate desire by questioning all existing values. He wanted, he said, to teach desire to desire, to desire better, to desire more, but above all, to desire in a different way. So that's an interesting set of thoughts, I think. And Thompson repeated Morris's warning that if workers were educated only to heed the contradictions and destructiveness of capitalism, then apart from their engagement in class struggle, they were always likely to fall back on the ruling ideas of the moment. It is the lack of any interest in discussing the details of the future, Thompson is saying, that in the later Marxist tradition, that led to the significant failings of the Marxist imagination itself. Its lack of moral consciousness or even a vocabulary of desire, its inability to project any image of the future, or even its tendency to fall back in lieu of these upon the utilitarian's earthly paradise, the maximization of economic growth, as the only image of the future. Meanwhile, Morris was far from alone in trying to broaden socialist visions of the future as the 20th century dawned. Edward Carpenter, later known as the Sexy Sage of Sheffield, was both practicing and tirelessly promoting an alternative culture and way of life, which would be, again, one that would create a more egalitarian world, where people lived more simply and closer to nature and closer to other creatures. So this sort of green image has been around for a very long time. And Carpenter puts his ideas into action at a place he's able to by in Millthorpe, where he wrote Love's Coming of Age. And in My Days and Dreams, Carpenter sketched his view of how people could build the alternative, inclusive culture he cherished, denouncing the widespread contempt for manual labor, the hypocrisies all around him, and the disdain for the pleasures of the body and men's control over women. As British feminist Sheila Rowbottom notes in her illuminating biography of Carpenter, his emphasis on the life of desire angered many male socialists of his day and after, such as George Orwell, eager to defend proletarian manliness against what he saw as pious dreamers with their vegetarian smell who go about in sandals, spreading sweetness and light. Rather like Edward Thompson a generation earlier, Rowbottom concludes that Carpenter tussles over how to create a new culture within the old without falling into prescription, how to establish collectivities which allow space for the personal, which allow space for spiritual aspirations of individuals. And these, she says, are of contemporary and not just historical interests. But I hardly need tell you that here. Meanwhile, Sheila, as I know her as, was busy researching and educating us about the forgotten feminist visionaries back then, whose past footprints are always so easily erased. Her book, Dreamers of a New Day, resurrects women who, from the 1880s up to the First World War, challenged all existing assumptions around sex and gender. This was the era of first wave feminism, of course, with its renowned struggle for the vote, for the women's right to vote. But much else was also stirring alongside that, that we hear less about. In Britain, militant trade union feminists such as factory worker Ada Neil Chu were campaigning for the 8-hour day, with Chu writing to her local paper that factory women needed time to read and enjoy nature. We cannot be said to live, she wrote. We merely exist. A living wage, an idea around now, ours is a lingering, dying wage. So women from all classes a century ago were, for a while, broadening their vision of women's emancipation beyond the struggle for the vote, including that, of course, into imagining comprehensive social transformation in all spheres, including their domestic and sexual lives. Again, many were campaigning for the expansion of municipal socialism, for the setting up of communal buildings with shared kitchens, nurseries, schools, and cultural facilities, as well as spaces for private living. Again, struggles which go on, particularly as most municipal building and housing has been sold off today. And certainly in London, where I come from, people literally find it almost impossible to afford any decent living at all. Travel and communication, although difficult then, was also crossing between Britain and the US, where black civil rights were already afoot, with campaigners like Ida B. Wells touring Britain with her wonderful oratory against slavery and against also the conditions of black people in the US at that time. Actually, it's after slavery, but it's still a time of lynching and enormous oppression of black people. And when women took to the streets over there to demand the 8-hour day, the Chicago Tribune reported that despite their worn faces and threadbare clothing, they shouted and sang and laughed, reporting that they showed a whirlwind of exuberance. And it's such energy and joy that I feel, yes, I'm not quite up to that slide yet, has often, but that's okay, has often accompanied moments of activism as people come together, moments of togetherness as people come together, demanding greater freedom and equality in the world. Thus, the successful 3-month strike at the Lawrence Textile Factory in Massachusetts in 1912 became iconic for the banners thought to be carried by its largely immigrant women there. We want bread, but we want roses too. Those banners apparently didn't exist, which has done nothing to undermine their joyful resonance for feminists and others down the years. Another utopian echo from that time is attributed to the anarchist feminist Emma Goldman. If there's no dancing at the revolution, I'm not coming. These were not her precise words either, although we can trace their source to her autobiography, Living My Life, where she insisted that it was important to try to live your desired futures in the present, where everyone could share equally in the world's resources, whatever the obstacles. And she angrily rejected the criticism she'd received from a comrade who thought her energetic dancing frivolous by endorsing everybody's right to beautiful, radiant things. That's where the quote comes from. The pioneering feminist Charlotte Perkins Gilman, some of you might have heard of, published her own fiction, Her Land, in 1915, illustrating a world of women combining work and community engagement with the joys of motherhood. Motherhood's something I'll mention again, where the joys are getting harder and harder as simply having the time to do caring work is becoming more and more difficult in the world today. Gilman and other women also called for public provision for housing to enable forms of cooperative living for home crafts, as well as large apartments with swimming pools, tennis courts, and dance halls for that energetic dancing. These earlier dreamers saw their differing utopian yearnings again submerged by war and the depression of the 1930s. But as Rowbottom rightly concludes from women's past and still ongoing battles, trying to bridge the personal and the political is quite as hard today as ever. There is no automatic accretion of improvement, only the need to reinvent utopia in every era. Indeed. Now, we can come to my next slide, because I said it was the women's liberation movement that would prove itself the first main beneficiary of 60s radicalism. The protests of its closing years were critical for women's renaissance and the renewal of our own utopian yearnings. 68 was the year that the US movement staged its first widely reported protests of the Miss American Beauty pageant in Atlantic City. You can still see that online, and it's so funny to see Bob Hope interrupted by the feminists there. It was also the year Adrienne Rich wrote her poem, Planetarium, a woman in the shape of a monster in the shape of a woman. The skies are full of them. And so they were, suddenly, it was raining women. So it was that 60s emphasis on culture and personal identity that fed into the exuberant rise of movement politics generally. At a time of greater sexual freedom, it was feminists pondering anew the nature of women's desires and bodies and motherhood and general caring role that really brought personal life into politics, though first always entangled with a collective vision involving shared resources. Moreover, for a few years, there really was progress on all fronts, and in particular, an expansion of those community resources alongside the blossoming of feminist culture and feminist life, some of which has continued to this day. Jam Today was the name of one of our favorite feminist bands, capturing the high hopes of the 70s movement. We might still be lacking in confidence, we mostly were, but feminists were not lacking in hopes, at times sharing the miraculous revolutionary power of joy, as one of them wrote. It's the lasting significance of those years that's helped many an aging feminist like me keep a certain political optimism alive, whatever the gloom we feel about the present, as I describe in my memoir, Making Trouble, yes, and that's me there objecting to pin-ups in the Islington Gazette, although strangely I seem to have a cigarette in my hand, whereas I tell my doctors I have never smoked. And I don't think it's even a joint. I don't know what it's doing there. Someone clearly put it in my hand. Anyway, as we know, sadly, something else was also stirring during the heyday of feminism that we hadn't foreseen. With inflation rising and recession looming in the late 70s, the right was also rapidly gaining ground. So in the UK, as in the US, it wasn't just class war that was soon back with a vengeance following the election of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, but a comprehensive cultural assault on so much that we had fought for, but also on those collectivity, those yearnings, whether spiritual or material yearnings, were all under attack. With economic survival more precarious, the social network sustaining progressive practice began to wither. Individual striving, not collectivity, were the new watchwords of neoliberal rationality, with weakness and vulnerability repackaged as pathology, we've still got this now, dependence as shameful, ruthless competitiveness imposed upon public and private sector alike, our spaces even for gathering together all being taken over by the private sector, extending that language of metrics and growth to everything, whether it's education, no matter what it is, you know, we're all to be measured in some, as though it's some market that we're producing commodities for sale. So I'm back full circle to the present, with every fiction writer then honing their skills on writing dystopias. There's the Nobel Prize winning writer Kazuo Ishiguro, Never Let Me Go, who writes about disposable people who are being bred for their body parts. Now, as we know, in fact, people having to sell their body parts is happening in the poorer parts of the world, and indeed women are renting out their wombs to produce babies for the First World War, the First World. And this, you know, commodification of simply everything, including all aspects of human life, is so much around us. And ironically, with distrust of the future rampant for many people. Our governments, meanwhile, have been busy measuring and comparing happiness. Indeed, happiness and well-being became key words for governments in the 1990s. Yet who knows what exactly is being measured when they imagined happiness to be was simply some inner attribute which we were being told to grow. And if we didn't feel happy enough, to get CBT in order to learn how to be happier. And so much, it's an individual commodity, as it were. So much is suppressed in current talk of happiness, not just the hidden coerciveness that means that we're now expected to display that smiley face, smile or die, as Barbara Ehrenreich has written, especially in our jobs, particularly in jobs like at Pret-a-Manger, if you're literally going to be monitored to see if you're smiling enough at the next customer, however precarious and grinding our jobs might be. Now, in reality, and I've got the next slide on depression, we now know that there are soaring rates of crippling depression and chronic anxiety around the globe, with one in six of us likely to suffer from depression or anxiety, one in four if we're women over 40, and probably figures for men are simply suppressed by the fact that they're not going to their doctors. Now, for certain, this keeps the pharmaceutical companies smiling, and nothing has been doing better than those producing antidepressant medicine, but it's a cruel fate for the spiraling hordes of people now being urged to heal themselves and get back into their jobs by the fastest means possible. So this is why in my latest book I suggest that happiness is not best seen as some inner quantifiable state detached from the world around us, but rather as a way of acting in the world, how we act in the world, which actually is how Aristotle saw it as a type of virtue back in 400 BC. It's an energy that attaches us to life, to doing things that seem meaningful and important to us. That's what I decide after looking for it, through what everyone has to say about happiness. A lot of it not making much sense. A lot of people saying it's very hard to talk about what happiness is. Hegel says the pages on happiness are the pages that are written white. But anyway, we'll probably talk more about that in the discussion. What I'm saying in my book is that we're never truly outside the social, even when solitary, or turning inwards in meditation or prayer or in aesthetic enjoyment, even when we feel this cosmic oneness with the world, when we're most sort of outside of ourselves, there also has to be a world there that we can come back to if we're not going mad. There has to be a world and the institutions of that world. And yet in today's precarious world, it's increasingly difficult for many people to forget the precarity and be able to move outside themselves as well as back into the world with a sense of their connectedness to other people. Thus, in my book, I've got a lot to say about what we might call public happiness, which was a term used by the political thinker Hannah Arendt, by which she meant the opportunities created within any society for people to move outside their own very personal concerns, whether happy or miserable, into some conscious participation in public life, in culture or politics or religion. In her view, it was here that people, whoever they were, should be able to engage collectively in the affairs of others, in the affairs of the day, each being respected as potential agents in the world at large. Indeed, for Arendt, some political engagement was necessary to sustain happy and healthy societies and vice versa. I also, in my chapter, What is Joy, which many of you will be interested in, engage in the debates between secular and religious traditions, with many people arguing that joy is something, and it was always seen as something tied to religion, something that when you feel closer to God, you feel more joy. Then there's a whole secular tradition which has said there are other ways of feeling at one with the world, other ways of feeling connected to others, but that to feel grounded, you have to be engaged with something bigger than yourself if you're not to be one in six or one of four of those people who are likely to be suffering from depression or anxiety. Also, I illustrate moments of collective joy. That's Women's Day in Spain, when all those 5 million people came to the street objecting to violence against women and many other things. I've got another slide there. That's me on a housing demonstration. As you know, housing is one of the worst provided, although essential, provisions for us today, that having sold off most of those municipal houses and so on, and we talk of affordable housing, but there's so little affordable housing for anyone. Fortunately, then, despite fears of the future, despite the precariousness we often face, a spirit of resistance and moments of collectivity to the disorders of the present have never entirely disappeared in recent decades, but rise and fall as circumstances allow and according to the different attachments we feel able to make. So the last decade has been nightmarish for many, yet it's also seen the growth of new forms of collectivity and new forms of struggle against obscene inequality, military violence and displacement and dispossession. And of course, we saw all that in particular in 2011, again taking everybody by surprise with the Arab Spring, with the occupations in the Western world, often inspired by the Arab Spring, with the rise of Black Lives Matter in the USA, with mass feminists marching around the world against Trump and against violence against women, as well as the continuing eruption of battles against austerity and the corporate invasion of public spaces, alongside refurbished queer and trans politics. And I, one of the attempts to keep public spaces cheerful is in all those, particularly those West Indian carnivals, which some of which I think are happening right now, are happening this very weekend. We always have the problem of the corporations trying to take them over. You know, I say a lot in the book about how festivities were once something often associated with the church, although the church at time also tried to stamp them out, but often after Lent was when you got the biggest festivals of all. But with the rise of capitalism, as Weber and others say, you get attempts to dampen down those moments of festivity when, you know, all the hierarchies of everyday life would be suppressed, as well as gender and other hierarchies would all be challenged just for the day, and everybody would end up doing exactly what they wanted to be doing, as well as drinking a lot and having a wonderful time. Edward Thompson wrote about the significance of those festivals for working class people, but you know, they're always being opposed and stamped out as we're meant to be back in work today, of course, in ever longer hours. And not only that, but with the commercialization of public spaces, it costs too much to go to festivals for most people, to go to any of the dancing or music or other festivals. It's just too expensive for most people to be able to come together in those moments of collective joy. And yet we try, and yet it's so important, it seems to me. So that more than ever, it remains clear that we need constant reinforcement of those moments of spontaneous or enduring forms of collective coming together, as here at Greenbelt, or I'm more familiar with the political moments of trying to come together against the inequalities and cruelties of our time. And yet, we also see a coming together of the populist right. We also see in Britain regressive forces of racism and misogyny and xenophobia, which have been growing around the world, obviously in the States, in India, in various parts of Europe, and feeding the Brexit vote, whatever good reasons people might have had for voting Leave, racism and xenophobia was definitely one of them, in what Priyanka Mishra, the Indian writer, sums up as the counter-democracy of the aggrieved. That's an ongoing tendency that those of us who have hopes for sharing the resources of the world have to find ways of trying to confront. And it's also why it's always been my view that on the one hand, it's equally important to seek out the broadest possible alliances and solidarities across religions and spiritualities, but also across all forms of collectivity that can be seen as open and progressive, as well as working in the institutionalized mainstream of parliamentary and trade union politics or Green Party, whichever ones are trying to deliver the most progressive forms of government possible. So while the future still looks bleak for troublemakers of any age, particularly, of course, for the elderly now facing such a crisis of care with the money being drained away from our municipal councils at the very same time as they're being told they have to put even more money into care work, I'm hardly the first person to note how quickly we can oscillate between despair and occasional delight, fear and rage and hope and attempts to provide for others as we face worsening situations for so many. With solidarity alone, it seems to me, however we come to find our solidarity, generating that defiant sense of hope, agency and belonging when we do manage to come together to fight for better times. And what's genuinely exciting about this moment is that despite and also because of the shared anxieties at the election of that reactionary populist, that with people dancing in Taksim Square, that although they're sending poisonous gas onto them from the Turkish authorities, they put on their masks and dance their resistance. They've got an even bigger struggle on their hands today. But I still sense a passionate interest in understanding why there is so much inequality and right-wing populism around. So there is today, it seems to me, a greater engagement in politics and in diverse forms of collectivity than I've seen for a very long time. And that takes me back, of course, to the heyday of movement politics when I come of age in the late 60s and 1970s. And that's, again, what I'm talking about in all sorts of different ways throughout this book, Radical Happiness, where I notice also that we sometimes renew our attachments to life by embracing both its real sorrows alongside its possible joys, that Blakean joy and woe are woven tight. And once we think of things that are far larger than ourselves is when it's easier to escape that gloomy tyrant of the self, which Freud also spoke about, by sensing that our worlds are, our own lives are tied to the lives of others. And it's also a way in which we often cross generational divides. So that's me in a few years' time, perhaps even tomorrow, as I still try and escape from myself but not by escaping from the world, but by trying to join others, knowing that equality, solidarity, care, and commitment of all sorts of different forms that are open to others were the values early feminists once tried to live by, explicitly rejecting the commodified life, enshrining simply consumption, competition, and ubiquitous subservience to corporate market values. So that's what I think many of us, and I'm sure many of us here, in whatever way we can, are still trying to live with today. And that's the utopian yearning tied in with those joyful moments that I think we have to try and live with, rather than one in thrall to the mindless motors of consumption and pointless growth. So that's, it seems to me, what we need if we're to have any tolerable future at all, and some people would say any future at all, 100 years from now for the human species. Thank you.
We've got about 5 minutes for questions, so we'll do that by people coming up to the front. We'd like to take more women than men, if possible, and we would like to have short, pithy questions, not whole manifestos. So quick, you got to come now if you want to ask a question. Don't wait. Perfectly fine to come and ask a question if you're a man, but we would like as many women as possible to feel able to be on the microphone.
Thank you very much. In your kind of retrospective of these moments, these paradigm-shifting moments of collective joy, which were linked to reform, like the Paris Commune, the early years of the Spanish Second Republic, and so on, the problem when I look at this is that they were moments, and you said the word moments, and we're living in an age where there's been an utter failure of the left to have anything sustained. I mean, here we're celebrating the victory of the left in Britain just by taking a few seats of a discredited Tory party. Could you say something more about the failure of the left to transform these paradigm-shifting moments of joy into a more sustainable long-term political program? Mm-hmm.
Should we take a couple more so we can answer them once?
Hiya, thanks for that fantastic talk. I would like to ask you, what movements in the current climate give you the most hope?
It's more a comment. Thank you very much for giving me the words to express something. I'm on the front line of the fracking fight, and I'm so excited by the colourful, carnivalesque, knitting nanas and all the yarn bombing and great fun that's going on the fracking front line, serious though it otherwise is. Thank you.
Let's take a final one.
I think people have cars, so they're in their cars and they lock their front doors. They're worried about their children going out. Technology has a lot to answer for as well. And Johan Hari's book, Lost Connections, The Real Causes of Anxiety and Depression, it's to be recommended. Like to read your book as well.
Okay, well, you know, utopia is never going to be a permanent thing. And even, you know, utopias are not so disconnected entirely from dystopias. We're always, I think, going to be involved in conflict and trying to keep on working to improve things. For me now, in the Labour Party, Corbyn is trying to work to improve things. If he manages to get into Parliament, endless conflict in relation to Corbyn. The Green Movement, the Green Party is also absolutely involved in trying to work against fracking and think about life in the future and the world's resources, which are not unlimited. You know, some people on the left have been around for a very long time. I'm not interested in just blaming people that we don't win power, because the right is so much more powerful than we are. It's so hard for us to be in charge of the media, to be in charge of that everyday sort of morning paper that is peddling the thoughts of the powerful and trying to blame the powerless for everything that is wrong, feeding racism, feeding all that sort of regressive resentment that I said Priyanka Mishra and many others have talked about. So, you know, all we can do is keep on going. And I don't think a politics of blame is particularly useful. There will always be conflict. And so working with as much openness as possible. And, you know, many of us have been around for 50 years and more, and all we can do is to keep going. And it will always be partial, our victories, but that is what we're going to have to do. And as for technology, this degrowth conference I was at had so much to say about that and how you stop carbon emissions, how you replace coal energy with solar power and so on. It's incredibly difficult and incredibly worrying, and we are going to have to consume less and consume differently, and that's an incredibly hard thing to do. Imagine if Corbyn started saying that, or John McDonald. I know they're very sympathetic to it. Imagine if they started to say that, what the media would do with it. So, you know, we keep on fighting in our different ways. We keep on sharing our prayers, whatever we're doing, to say, you know, things could be different. We don't need to live with this harshness and cruelty, although probably it will never completely go away. But we can, you know, we can work for better times and a better world here and now, and that the sort of utopias of the here and now, many people are actually engaged in them, and they can spread, and they have to spread. Thank you.